building a lot.
We open the Housing Committee on Rural Communities Land Use and Water. Today is Thursday, March 5th at 1:15. And let me open public hearings on House Bills 2674 and 2675. And ask the co-chair to join us, and Mary Beth, and if you have anybody else in your cadre, that's fine too, but it's just you two, that's fine.
Sure.
Tell us about these two interesting bills, and I'm not totally sure how related they are to each other. They're like completely separate concepts. So,
good afternoon, Chair Klein, members of the committee. I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature. They are related, Chair Klein. As you know, there was the GMO work group that Ivan was part of, and he'll be talking. I think most. Well, he'll probably talk about both bills. I'm gonna do an intro on House Bill 2675, if that's all right, and he'll introduce 2674, if that's all right, and talk about them and talk about the different concepts in each one of the bills. House Bill 2675 proposes to provide the Oregon Department of Agriculture the authority to regulate genetically engineered crops to ensure peaceful coexistence with organic crops grown in our state. The two main components are things our state often does well: communication and coordination. The communication begins when a royalty payment is completed to purchase genetically engineered seeds or plants. If an Oregon retailer or wholesaler is the one who obtains the signature of the purchaser on the agreement, the retailer or the wholesaler provides the ODA with a copy of the royalty agreement. If the purchaser signs a royalty agreement directly with the patent holder or the patent holder's agent, then the purchaser would provide the department with a copy of the signed agreement. So that's basically the communication part, that the department would know from these agreements being provided to them that the crops have been purchased with the intention of being grown. The ODA is then authorized to use this royalty agreement information to monitor various GE and non-GE crops and other plants, as well as to conduct related research. The ODA uses the information to designate crop production areas for the growing of GE crops and other plants to ensure safe coexistence. The ODA may also limit the growing season within those GE crop production areas, if necessary, to protect other farmers' crops. An individual may also petition the ODA to establish a specific crop production area, and the ODA may authorize the production area if the GE crop does not threaten non-GE crops and other plants currently co-located in the production area. I'm going to provide this testimony to your administrator, Mr. Chair, so it can be posted on OLIS. We were just running a little short time today. Though actually we had more time. On a broader level, the ODA may designate areas of the state to as off limits for all GE crop production. These reserve areas would be treated as control areas under current Oregon law, such as the canola control areas. I know how difficult control area issues can be, and this bill does not mandate but allows the ODA to regulate as needed for coexistence. The ODA would have the authority to manage crop production, reserve and control areas in such a way to maintain appropriate distance and temporal isolation as to prevent cross-contamination and unintended gene flow between GE and non-GE crops and other plants. This is especially important as contamination with GE crops and other plants places the recipient farmer not only at an economic disadvantage, but in potential legal jeopardy due to patent infringement. House Bill 2675 makes the failure to provide required information or violation of department order regarding crop production area, production limitations, or reserve area subject to civil penalty not to exceed $10,000. Now, Chair Klem, you've consistently been willing to engage in discussions on how we can promote the success of every Oregon farmer, and I look forward to participating in the discussions this session on this proposal and other proposals aimed at the same goal. I should note that the issue of safe existence for both hemp and marijuana crops in Oregon has been raised in the Measure 91 Committee, which your vice chair is part of. And if there's an agreement between the two groups on how to ensure safe coexistence as both crops move into legal production, this bill might be used as a vehicle for that agreement to be codified. Meetings between representatives for hemp and marijuana growers are being set for the next week. Again, I appreciate your time and consideration. I brought with me my chief of staff, Mary Beth Williams, to help answer questions on the bill, particularly if the committee has questions concerning GM patents and other technical issues in the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So that's 2675.
2675.
Okay. And did you want to talk about the other one or somebody else going to do that?
Ms. Chair, I'd like to defer to Ivan to introduce the other bill.
Well, let's take questions. I know you have probably budgets you're supposed to be balancing, so let's take questions in case you need to leave for Representative Buckley at this point. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Representative. And if we need to ask others this question, it's fine. But I wanted to note that you said no mandates, but there seem to be requirements. I need to sort through that.
Chair Clam and Representative Gilliam, thank you. It's a great question. There are requirements to report the agreement that's signed, the royalty agreement that is signed. That would be required to be presented to ODA. ODA would be allowed to. They'd have the ability then to regulate grow areas if they decide that was necessary for coexistence. So there would be a requirement by the farmer who plans to use the GE seeds or plants in their fields. They would be required to report to ODA. ODA would be required to make that information available to other farmers as well, but they would not be required to develop a control area unless the department felt it was necessary to ensure safe coexistence.
Thank you for that answer. Quick follow-up, Mr.
Yeah, follow-up.
Chair. I wanted to talk just briefly about your statement that two things that the state does well, communication and coordination. And I believe that you and Ways and Means and our chair here do those two things. The rest of the state, I'm not sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I appreciate the comment. Sometimes, like with the progress that's made in healthcare with coordinated care organizations, was something I was thinking about there. And we're starting to make some progress with the early learning hubs as well. That by coordinating efforts, I think we're stronger as a state when we coordinate what we're doing. And I share the view of I know that Chair Clem and others have expressed. I want all farmers to succeed, and the only way we're going to do that is if we coordinate how we're doing it.
Well said.
Okay, any further questions for Representative Buckley? I know Mary Beth can answer these other ones because they're sort of technical about royalty agreements, so I can save it for you. Okay, so why don't we hear about 2674 as well, if that's okay, and then we might have more questions.
All right. Well, Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ivan Molesky with Friends of Family Farmers. We're the state's largest sustainable agriculture advocacy organization with over 5,000 members and supporters statewide. I'm also a farmer in Linn County. I was going to introduce House Bill 2674, but I also have testimony on both bills. Would it be appropriate to do
sure.
that at this time as well?
Yep. Well, we got you.
All right. So just the basics on 2674, as was mentioned by Representative Buckley, I was a member of the governor's task force on genetic engineering this last year. And we provided some bullet points to Representative Buckley on some ideas that were sort of percolating in that discussion group. And that really forms the basis of House Bill 2674. As often happens, you know, there's likely some tweaks that need to be made, but I'll at least give you the overview on what the bill does. First of all, uses the control area approach slightly differently than 2675, though there are some overlaps between the two bills. First of all, 2674 would require the Oregon Department of Agriculture to create control areas for genetically engineered crops by January 1st, 2016. It makes genetically engineered crops grown outside of those established control areas subject to eradication. It requires ODA regulations for crops that are not approved for unregulated use. So what's going on here is that at the federal level, the United States Department of Agriculture either has crops in a regulated status, which means they're essentially test crops, or a deregulated status, which really means kind of the Wild West in terms of regulation. So this provision would specifically say that if there are test crops being grown in Oregon, the Oregon Department of Agriculture would have some local regulations to ensure that those aren't causing undue harm in the state. Further, the bill would require that Oregon Department of Agriculture sets up a program for financial assistance for those farmers who are damaged by unwanted genetic contamination from genetically engineered crops. And it would establish a fund for this purpose and impose a fee on genetically engineered seeds to direct money into this fund. Lastly, it requires Oregon Department of Agriculture to make regular reports to the legislature on control areas, crop regulation, and the financial assistance program. So that's the general overview of what this bill does.
So is the now I think I understand the royalty agreement thing a little bit better. Is the royalty agreement really designed to furnish information that then might be a trigger to saying, okay, we know in this area now there's these crops and these crops. We know in the Hood River Valley there's pears grown. We also know there are cherries grown. What we don't know is which are GE and which aren't. There aren't any in this case because they don't make them for those two yet, but they just came out with one for apples recently, I saw. So there may very well be one someday. So in trying to get information to know whether there may be a conflict, you're trying to figure out how to get the Department of Ag information, which is why royalty agreements?
Representative Klim, members of the committee, yes. Currently, Mary Beth Williams, Representative Buckley's Chief of Staff. Currently, the way that patented materials are handled is through royalty agreements. So every genetically engineered seed, plant, tree that is currently produced is under a patent agreement. And in order for someone to use that trait, that patented trait, you have to have a licensing agreement. And those are currently called, the Legislative Council calls those royalty agreements. In order for the patent holder to know where you're exercising that patent, that you have to give them direct information, very specific information. So a patent holder would know where the GE trees were being grown in Linn County or Marion County, very, very specifically, because they need to know if their patent is in fact moving around and or being used, infringed by someone else.
Is there are there financial information included in there? I'm wondering about these sort of privacy of potential business transactions on how much they paid and that kind of thing versus just the locations.
Representative Columbia, I understand. Currently, the royalty agreements, the technology agreements that I've seen do not have the amounts. They are essentially contracts.
Yeah.
So you would pay for your seed, but you would sign the contract.
Yeah.
So there would not be proprietary information as far as the amounts paid. In addition, we foresee that ODA, through regulation, could be made exempt from public records law.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. Yeah, Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Chair Klim. I have about 1, 2, 3, 4 questions. Would that be all
sure.
right?
Yep.
Let me just
rattle
them off. And
yeah, we left basically only my annexation bills, which can be heard any time today. So we have all the time we need for this, and mine can move if we run out of time.
Very generous. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
Hope you vote for him. I'm not sure about that. But
okay. Couple of things that just pop out to me right away. And let me pull this up in front of me. Is how would this affect home use, non-commercial, of GE plants products?
Chair Klim, Vice Chair Post, I don't believe there are contracts for home use of genetically modified crops. I'd have to find that information. I'm not aware of any home, individual homeowner who is purchasing the GMO seeds.
Okay, all right. That was something that popped into my head. The other was would there be the problem with the farmer's rights to choose what kind of crop that they want to grow on their land if it's not in the control area? So are we taking away the choice?
Chair Klim, Vice Chair Post, no. The farmer would still be able to choose. The only distinction is if they are genetically engineered crops, this bill would envision the department being able to set up a system to ensure whatever that crop that was growing would not endanger the crop of a neighboring farmer. So the choice would still be the farmer as to what they chose to grow.
Okay. All right, then just going back to the ballot measure language, this just stands out to me when I read the title, makes genetically engineered commodity grown outside authorized control area subject to eradication. Eradication scares me. I don't like that word. Who's eradicating? How are they able to?
Chair Clem, Vice Chair Post, there would be a fine to, if the department were to set up a control area, and if a farmer was to grow a crop that was not allowed outside of that control area, in an area where the crop was not allowed, the farmer would be subject to a fine. And my assumption, the department by rule would set up the process for how the crop would then be removed from the area in which it is not allowed to be grown.
Okay. The last one, this would be to preempt Representative Gomberg. 2674 has an emergency clause, 2675 does not. Is there reasoning behind that?
Vice Chair, or Chair Clem, Vice Chair Post, first, it's always good to preempt Representative Gomberg when you have a chance. Second, the issue of having an emergency clause is not something that I've really focused on at all. It's not something that's important.
Thank you.
And since Representative McLean is here now, I think I'll take my leave. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? I might mention there is a Senate bill that I asked not to really have talked about particularly today because I want to give these their own concepts. They also talk about districts and areas. They've got some amendments. They're not in harmony with each other, but they have some different triggers. So my thought after we get through this is at some point for members, like a subcommittee of members maybe who are really interested in this, is also see if we could hash out the differences between the Senate bills, which don't use the term control area. They use some other term. So this won't be your last opportunity, but the more you ask questions, the more you're likely to get on that committee with me. So Post is already on it, for example, I noticed. And
I haven't even been
here. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so any further questions on Representative Gilliam?
I hate to risk being part of that, but
Appointed. Sorry.
That's okay. Reminds me of Carolyn Tomei. Anyway.
Slowly a turn.
I have a... I've had some heartburn. In fact, as I read over this bill a little more in depth, I almost hear Heartbreak Hotel playing in the background. The requirement that ODA now set up a fee gives me some heartburn. The idea of a fee on this does, but for the department, I don't know that they've done this kind of thing in the past, and I think we're setting up a precedent for regulation that at least I'm not familiar with the department ever being required to administer.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam. Actually, the ODA does have a fee schedule when it comes to seeds. So whenever a seed manufacturer, seed wholesaler, seed retailer wants to sell seeds in the state of Oregon, then they have to pay a fee. So this is actually very not new and would fit in well with that because the seed costs, in fact, cover the database and other management of the seed.
To follow up, if I can, Mr.
Yeah,
Chair.
Follow up.
I appreciate that information. I had sort of forgotten that. It just seems to me to be a little different, or maybe quite a bit different,
yeah,
to be required to set up a fund for anticipated damages. It's a little different than fund for expenses that you can anticipate.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, those are good questions. I think that part of the hope with a fee structure is to not only cover potential damages that a farmer may experience, but while it may not exactly be in the bill, I think there's a lot of merit to talking about how do you fund the administrative function of the agency, and that was certainly a topic we discussed in the task force. And so I think that those are good questions, and I think, what would the purpose of such a fee be? the intent in part is that that if a farmer does can demonstrate some harm from cross-contamination, you can typically trace that back to a specific gene sequence owned by a company. So the idea would be to have that, that cushion there available if someone experiences financial harm. And we've seen some serious, you know, potential problems emerge in Oregon with the weed incidents a couple of years ago. To the extent that those types of things are a risk, we think it would be a good idea, a good policy idea, to have some sort of compensation available. How you actually do that is a good question.
Quick follow-up. Ivan, what kind of a cushion could we anticipate? Do you have, we have estimates?
Chair Clem, Representative Gillian, I do not.
So your point being you'd want to see some damages before you start collecting it, and then there aren't any, then there's this money that we sweep during an emergency session kind of thing.
Worries.
Yeah. Okay. What other questions do we have at the moment, at least? Well, we have other witnesses to testify, and we can always haul Ivan back up or Mary Beth. Representative McLean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question to the gentleman. I don't have a for me, but I'm sure you do, for the science that would justify government intervention and imposition of liability for variance to this regulation. But do you have anything to justify? Now, I know there's a lot of fear, and I know it's a politically a hot potato. But do you have any research or any data that shows that a GE plant that's been like approved by the USDA is a threat to a non-GE plant of the same type? And if so, has there been any testing and validation to show that the buffer zones have to be a certain feet?
So, Chair Clem, Representative McLean, I have not yet delivered my full testimony. I just wanted to give the summation of the bill, and I've tried to address some of those questions. But the short answer is yes. With certain crops that are open pollinated, it's well established that they can outcross to similar crops. And so when you get that, and that can create cross-contamination. This is a well-known issue in the specialty seed industry. In fact, there are multi-mile set-asides observed in the Willamette Valley amongst growers of various crops in order to segregate genetically engineered sugar beet seed, for example, from conventional beet or chard seed. In fact, the Oregon Department of Agriculture maintains a control district, a control area already for one genetically engineered grass species, bent grass. It's both banned from the Willamette Valley by administrative rule and restricted in Jefferson County in Central Oregon, where it's grown commercial or grown somewhat commercially. So it's and further, I can follow up with on this with you afterwards, but there's some good research out of Oregon State University. Carol Mallory Smith is a weed professor there, and she's published studies that talk about the miles that some crops may need to be isolated in order to prevent cross-contamination. And at the end of the day, when you're dealing with markets where they're testing for thresholds, say, let's say you export alfalfa hay to Korea, you're going to need to have negative tests on whether that was genetically engineered or not. Otherwise, you know, your shipment may be turned back. So the fact that, you know, alfalfa can hybridize, whether it's genetically engineered or not, is well established.
Great. Can I follow?
Yeah, follow.
Fantastic. What I think would be very helpful to me in this committee is that you would produce a memo to Chair Clem and CCS and actually line up all the specific scientific studies that you're relying on for this bill so that we could have an opportunity to vet it and so that we're not making a decision out of a non-science-based purpose. Would you be willing to do that?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, absolutely.
Thank you.
I will say this is a little bit different than some of the discussions I've heard where I really do question whether it's fair science when it's more about safety of eating it, for example, because a lot of these issues are market access issues more than they are questions of safety. So we don't use GE crops, partially because there aren't any that really sound good to me in tree fruit yet. But I did hear about one that came out just a week ago or two that's an apple that doesn't brown as easily. That might be of interest. The challenge would be we'd have to probably forego selling those in Europe and a variety of other places. So then you got to decide, is it really worth it or not? And so a lot of it's not going to be so much scientific, because it may be the illogic of Europe that stops me from wanting to do it. It's not, it's more of a, I can't make any money doing it, so why would I do this? Because my customers don't want it kind of issue. Versus some of the other debates I've heard, this I think is actually a pretty good debate to have about how, when you have market problems and you're trying to exist in the same area, what do you do? What do you do? If somebody moves in right next to me, which this happened originally, and they were organic, I was pretty freaked out about that. I'm like, am I going to get sued because I ruined their certification, you know, unless I cut back a bunch of trees or something like that? We worked it out between ourselves. It's been fine. But I was a little bit nervous about, you know, being accused. We were there first for a long time, and I was a little bit worried about this person moving in. And what kind of problems we might have trying to coexist with each other, literally abutting. You know, we had rows 12 feet away from each other at one point. But I think this is probably mostly about the consumer issues more than it is the consumer's buying behavior and the conditions of the European Union and Asia than it is like debates you would have about whether we should ban them because they're unsafe for humans, for example.
Can I follow up?
Yeah.
Is that what this bill's about? Is consumer perceptions versus science?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, I would not say it's about consumer perception per se. That may be the case in some situations. I think that there are very real market issues. It's not just exports to some of our biggest trading partners that are potentially at risk here. During the canola debate last year, we heard from cover crop seed growers in the Willamette Valley that supply the Midwest, and they're very concerned about Roundup Ready canola seed ending up in their cover crop mixes because it could have lost them customers or impacted their market. So I guess I would say that this is really about a crop management issue and how do we manage a challenging coexistence issue here in Oregon where we have a diversity of crops. Whether the markets accept them or not is a bigger question, and we're not, we have to sell the markets that will buy our products. And in Oregon, we would argue that the vast majority of our markets are not really dependent on genetic engineering, and in fact, we specialize in largely in providing non-genetically engineered products, and that's so. At the end of the day, this is about how do you protect those non-GMO markets and farmers here in Oregon from our perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In a couple of terms that I've heard here, yours, the notion of coexistence, and Ivan's description of isolation, and I think those are key terms, key concepts here. Ivan, I went on a tour that you and others sponsored, where we looked at a number of different brassicas, and folks had learned to coexist because neighboring farmers respected the need for isolation. I'm very concerned because, the camel's nose, I think, started with canola. And now I'm hearing that, we could possibly sideline GMO crops someplace because there is a group that doesn't approve of that. What happens among brassica farmers when I'm the minority turnip grower and all my neighbors are growing broccoli and they said, Brad, we don't want your turnip anymore. Okay, so now we have the state of Oregon deciding what crops individual farmers are allowed to grow or not, and that is an exceedingly slippery slope that I don't want to go down. And I respect the agricultural community in this state's ability to be able to design isolation among neighbors so that they can all get along. I sincerely would hate to begin a system where we start evaluate, we say thumbs up or thumbs down on individual crops. I think that's a horribly wrong foot to get off on.
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, if I could respond. The issue here, I think, is bigger. Those are good points. I want to give some context. I'm getting my testimony, but you'll recall that the legislature passed Senate Bill 863 as part of the grand bargain special session. And that bill not only preempted local communities from enacting seed or products of seed type rules, it actually had a declarative finding that these issues are now under the exclusive regulatory power of the state of Oregon. So for folks who have supported that bill and wanted that bill to be law, that is now the policy of the state of Oregon. That these are under the exclusive regulatory power of the state of Oregon. And what we said at the time in opposing that bill was that the state of Oregon does not currently regulate. And so what do you, you know, that's sort of an untenable situation for farmers that may be experiencing economic risk or potential legal liability from poorly managed genetically engineered crops, that what is the state's approach? And so that's why this task force was formed, to try to answer some of those questions. Some of the key findings of that task force, which the legislature spent about $100,000 to impanel, and we think we met 13 times, that there needs to be clarity on the state's approach to these issues. That was a key finding. Another key finding was that there are significant data gaps in terms of how these crops are being grown and where they're being grown in the state. And that ultimately there's a need to protect organic, conventional, non-GE, and even GE crops. So we need to find a way to provide protections that actually are meaningful. So the reason why I bring up the state's existing control area authority is because this is an area of law that the state already has, the legislature's already created. It's Oregon ORS 570.405, and it specifically talks about that the ODA may set up these control areas for the eradication or exclusion from such areas of certain plants or their produce that may be a menace to such areas and generally to horticultural, agricultural, and forestry industries. So this law is already on the books, and that's the authority under which the ODA has already segregated genetically engineered bent grass to protect the grass seed industry here in the Willamette Valley. So between this, the legislature saying deciding that this is under the exclusive regulatory power of the state, and given the state's existing authorities, it's really a question more of what does this authority look like. And these bills, we'd be happy to discuss with anyone how to make them better. But at the end of the day, I don't think we can walk away from the what we believe was the mandate in Senate Bill 863, which is to have the state more involved than it currently is in the management of these challenging issues.
Mr. Chairman, may I?
Yeah, follow up and then come over here.
Thank you. Ivan, I don't think that setting up a pinning system whereby neighbors get to talk to each other and discuss their concerns and their needs to be able to have different crops coexist, I don't think that's abandoning our state's obligation. To the contrary. And I think that on an individual basis, you may be able to make very good arguments that there may be reasons for specific individualized crops to be segregated. But as a general overall policy, again, I am extremely concerned that we start down the pathway to selection of what crops does the state of Oregon determine are okay for individual farmers to grow. I understand that your concern that adequate protections be in place. I am concerned that we start crop selection, and I can't believe that any farmers want that to be happening. I just don't believe it.
Well, Chair Clem, Representative Witt, On the first part of your question, in the specialty seed industry, where seed purity is very important for both the genetically engineered producers as well as the non, there's that issue of mutual, everyone's got mutual risks. So there's a lot of incentive to participate in the voluntary pinning system and mapping system. The challenge is for some of these crops and growers who are not part of the voluntary association, they're essentially left out, potentially cold, and they're not protected. So there are farmers who've submitted testimony on these bills who support a greater state oversight, and so I wanted to call that to your attention. I think also that while the state, it is important to have some basic protections. At the end of the day, I think you've got to gather data. You can protect some of the information to make sure it's not private business information that's disclosed, but you've got to gather data, and you've got to be able to use that to make informed choices about some best management practices. Sometimes those best management practices may include, from our perspective, having areas where that are essentially reserves where GE crops aren't grown. But I think that ultimately we need to clarify that the state of Oregon and the Oregon Department of Agriculture can use the facts that they can gather, the best science, and make some of those management decisions. Because at the end of the day, some of the market impacts, some of the liability questions are significant enough that merely voluntary systems aren't always going to be the process that works. And, you know, in fact, 1,000 handshake agreements across the landscape is arguably more of a patchwork than a county-by-county approach that the legislature moved away from with Senate Bill 863.
Representative McClain. And then we'll let you actually give your testimony.
I guess I'm coming back to try to understand why you're advocating for it, and maybe it's just that you believe that the legislative requirement of Senate Bill 863 in 2013 is that there must be regulation that follows. And okay, so that's a third area. The second area I've heard and I've asked you about is consumer or, you know, customer preferences. And then, but I get back to the science aspect, in which you're going to get me what science you're relying on, but I keep getting a little bit unclear, because if cross contamination, if you will, if that's the right word, if that is not a new thing. So if that occurred prior to genetically engineered plants, then how did the state survive 156 years of being one of the best agricultural states in the country when you had that occur before?
Representative Clem, I'm sorry, Chair Clem, Representative McClain, I'm actually going to jump in here in just a second, because there is this third issue that we haven't been talking about other than market share that I think will help address what you're talking about. In 2002, there was a Supreme Court case that determined that these materials could be patented. And once they became patented, they created a liability in people who receive them inadvertently. And recently, we've had two major decisions, one by the Supreme Court and one by the Fed Circuit, which handles patent law, that said that inadvertent infringement is actually actionable under the law. So there's no such thing as we've thought of as innocent infringement. If you have a patented material in your field, it doesn't matter how it got there, it's strict liability. So I think that one of the things we're looking at, it is the responsibility of the state of Oregon to protect people from inadvertent infringement through no fault of their own. So I think that is the third thing. It's not just about market share. It's actually about farmers and other people ending up with, we never expected self-replicating patented material to be set free. That patent law never envisioned that. So currently, until federal patent law catches up with state law, we are at a dilemma. So making sure that we keep our farmers safe, it's not just a market issue. It's also a legal liability issue.
Can I just follow up? Okay. I just want to make sure, since we're going to engage in this discussion, that I really understand what it is. I mean, one of the great representatives who's ever been on this committee said, if it ain't what's broke that needs fixing? Or if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Or I fix what's broke, or whatever the heck you said. What did
May
you say?
I step in and correct?
Oh, yeah.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Okay, sorry. Bill Post, the great Bill Post, once said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I'm trying to figure out what's broken.
Representative Chair Clem, Representative McLean, currently our patent system is broken in how it handles patented self-replicating materials, whether that be seeds or currently microbes are now being patented, which will also be released. Trees are the largest, the highest number of patents for genetically engineered materials currently are trees. So soon trees will be grown that are genetically engineered in Oregon, and if they spread their pollen and cross-contaminate other trees not on the patent, the person who has that royalty agreement, they're protected. Anyone who does not have that royalty agreement is not protected. So it currently is, in fact, broken.
Okay. Can I have one last question then? Is there non-GE plants that are patented?
They are patented under a different patent system. They are generally patented under the Plant Variation Protection Act, which doesn't require that you cannot save seeds and replant them, and it doesn't require the same. These are utility patents. They were really meant for, you know, if you're making some type of you know, anything that's not a plant. These were never expected. Utility patents aren't even supposed to be used for human life or plant life or any type of life. And suddenly, because of some recent decisions, that's happening now. So the patent system needs to catch up.
Well, thank you for this indulgence. I just wanted to know what lens to view testimony, because this is a pretty significant ask.
Yes, and then we're going to let Ivan actually testify. And we've got four other people to testify.
That's okay, fine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so to use the what's broke?
The great.
the great. Our patent system is broken, is what you said. And so you just have to help me because I'm new. Don't those come from outside of Oregon?
Chair Clem, Representative Post, Vice Chair Post, yes, in fact, they do. This is an area of the law that is completely handled by federal law. It just is that we here as a state and our responsibility to the people, our farmers, you know, that is our responsibility. So if we can somehow protect our farmers by requiring there not to be cross-contamination or doing our best to prevent cross-contamination, we would be, in fact, helping our farmers. And as Ivan said, this is not just a problem with GE and non-GE. There are types of GE now, if they cross-contaminated with other GE, would be very harmful. So, and it would also cause a liability, a patent liability.
Could I get information on that? I mean, I'm kind of a nerd in this regard, in that I like reading court opinions. Can you get me the basis of law that says that inadvertent presence or pollinization or is a strict liability when it comes to civil damages?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, yes, I definitely can. It was a recent decision in the past 2 years.
Okay, and I'd appreciate if you could give me that case.
Okay, I would want you to testify.
Right.
We'll get to the other folks.
Well, Representative Clem, members of the committee, I really appreciate your questions and the discussion of the issue. We believe that this is part of the intent of making these putting these issues under the state's jurisdiction, so we're glad to be having the discussion. Just a little background on our organization. I mentioned earlier we represent farmers statewide. We work with a wide range of farmers, including organic, conventional, and those who produce genetically engineered crops. We did serve on the 2014 Task Force on Genetic Engineering. And so our testimony is really kind of geared towards some of that, and generally what we think are some good ideas in these bills. We did submit this in written form, so I'll paraphrase. I mentioned already that through Senate Bill 863, the state has placed these issues under the state's exclusive regulatory power. And there are very real problems out there. There's really no state regulation over the vast majority of these crops. And currently, the Oregon Department of Agriculture does not believe that its current existing authority allows it to be proactive in making sure that there are some rules of the road to protect farmers who may be at risk of contamination. This leaves many organic and conventional farmers at risk, both in terms of the integrity of the seed supply, potential market losses, and legal liability. So I've mentioned what the state's task force key policy considerations were. Those included clarifying the state's role in the regulatory framework, trying to provide better protection for organic and conventional non-GE markets in addition to GE crops, and filling in the data gaps on the use of GE crops in Oregon. And we think that both of these bills are good attempts at addressing these policy needs. One of the context I want to give you here, though, is that these were some overarching themes that were identified by the task force. First, unlike the Midwest, where it's really just a handful of genetically engineered crops that dominate, commodity crops that dominate the agriculture production, Oregon is highly diversified, with the vast majority of crops and agricultural economic output not related to genetic engineering. And we further got very well-developed specialty seed, organic, and export markets that are highly sensitive to genetic contamination. This theme of more data is needed also came up quite a bit. We are so small, we're such a blip on the screen in terms of the use of these crops that the United States Department of Agriculture really just puts Oregon in a list of a dozen or two other states that they track. So when they're looking at corn, cotton, soy, the big GMO crops, they list several Midwest states individually, but Oregon, we're such a small user that they're really the tracking is largely non-existent, and this is particularly for federally deregulated crops that the USDA has deregulated. This is a detriment to being able to have sound, informed policies, and that's ultimately what we're trying to get at here, is how do we manage these issues in ways that are fair. But because it's no longer apparently available on the governor's website, we did provide the task force's report to you as an attachment to our testimony. So if you don't have time to read the entire 30 pages, at least take a look at the opening, the introduction, the first four pages or so. So I just wanted to address briefly this issue of the use of control areas for genetically engineered crops. We believe that better oversight and management by ODA would not be a difficult thing. It could be funded by some sort of a fee system paid for by developers and distributors of genetically engineered seeds. The legislature has already granted ODA this authority through its existing control area statute, ORS 570.405. I quoted from that earlier. It references plants that may be a menace to agricultural industries. ODA has used this to prevent canola from being widely grown in the Willamette Valley, particularly around disease issues. It also uses it to prevent the giant cane grass, or limit it to for biomass production to a small corner of Northeast Oregon. And as mentioned, there's actually one that is for a genetically engineered herbicide-resistant bentgrass variety that initially escaped into the wild in eastern Oregon back in the early 2000s, and so it presents a real risk to commercial bentgrass growers here in the Willamette Valley, and so is restricted by administrative rule. So there's a precedent here. ODA already does this. And from our perspective, through the establishment and maintenance of this existing bentgrass control area, it's quite clear that ODA the state of Oregon has already determined that genetically engineered crops can be a menace to other agriculture industries and sometimes do need some regulation. And in order to sort of underscore this, another attachment I provided with my testimony is a 2001 memo from the Oregon Department of Justice to ODA that articulates what it believes the control area authority to be. And so it's a four-page memo. It's titled Authority to Use Control Areas under ORS 570.405 to Set Up Districts to Separate Conventional and Bioengineered Crops. It spells out the state's authority, so that's in the public record as well. So because of this legal framework that we already have in Oregon, this history, and ODA's lack of willingness to be proactive in using this authority, we believe that the ODA or the legislature should act this year to direct Oregon Department of Agriculture to use its authority where appropriate to help set up management districts, control areas, what have you, to protect non-GE markets, non-GE farmers from potential genetic contamination. And that may be on a case-by-case basis, a crop-by-crop basis, a region-by-region basis, but we've got to be able to give the Department of Agriculture the tools to do this and manage this challenge. The last thing I'll say is a number of farmers, and you've got this in testimony, I saw several farmers submitted testimony either in support of these bills or offering ideas that they believe could perhaps better replace them. But there is a technological fix out there. Some farmers argue that this is just flawed technology. You know, if you raised pigs or cattle and they broke through a fence and tore through another farmer's field, you couldn't get off scot-free if you created that kind of damage. But in this case, with genetic engineering, we have the potential for pollen that has an herbicide resistance or some other engineered component being able to cross property lines, pollinate on another farmer's property, and create economic harm that there's really no recourse for. So the technological fix here is to simply require that the producers of these seeds make them sterile so that they can't replicate. And that would obviate the need for control areas and all this management and fees, et cetera. But it's a simple technological fix. It's doable, and it's not in either of the bills, but I wanted to bring it up because a lot of farmers are talking about it, and maybe it could be part of the discussion as we move forward. Because if we could have a win-win technological fix on this, that may be a good way to go as well. So I wanted to flag that for your attention. So thank you very much for your time. We look forward to the ongoing discussion and glad that you're taking up these issues.
Any further questions? And then we've got Pat, do you want to join us? I'll just fit you in while we still have an empty seat. And then we've got a panel for folks on both bills. We have both bills open. So why don't you come up and we'll just finish. We didn't know if there's going to be 100 people here or four. It turns out there's about 8. So we'll just finish with you and then we'll do the other 4. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Pat Williams. I'm a resident of Salem, Oregon, and I'm a member of the public that is concerned about GMO crops. I did not bring any prepared testimony, and it's hard to follow these expert folks that spoke very, very eloquently. I attended almost all of the governor's task force on GMO that were open to the public, and learned quite a bit. And I also submitted written testimony to the governor's task force, to that report that Mr. Molesky referenced. And I can modify that for this. The testimony I put in deals a lot with the report they wrote, so I'll modify that and submit it to this committee also. I have several points as I was sitting there thinking that I'd like to. Anyway, I would first like to say, and I suppose this is probably the most important thing, I stand in favor of both bills. The first one would require the state of Department of Agriculture to establish control areas, and once again, as
come back just a little bit. You can't hear it, but it's kind of messing up the microphone.
Okay, is this right? Is this good?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, it's okay.
I believe that it would be really helpful for the Oregon Department of Agriculture to establish control areas. Not necessarily a control area, but at least areas that we could see where the crops are. Pinning is another phrase that was used for that, to pin points on a map so people would know where the GMO crops are. And as mentioned in the earlier testimony, these crop genes do migrate. They do cause a problem. They pose enormous problem. The damage and the potential for damage is entirely from the GMO side to the non-GMO side. There's no ifs and buts about it. People will bring up different things about how a sugar beet might affect a chard. Well, that doesn't matter, and you might hear some testimony on that. It doesn't matter whether it's a GMO or non-GMO and where that's coming from. The sugar beet would hurt the chard or vice versa. I'm not quite clear on which damage goes which direction. But it does not involve GMO at all. It's the damage is, I'll reiterate, entirely from the GMO crop side to the non-GMO crop side. So farmers who grow traditional crops and organic crops need to have that sort of protection to protect their fields from cross-pollination, which does happen. And as you, I was unaware of a Supreme Court decision that puts the liability on the farmer who inadvertently received that cross-pollination that that they were in, they, it was their fault, basically, or they were liable for it, basically, even though they weren't at fault. I'd like to say that the FDA had, at one time, decided that GMO crops were equivalent to traditional crops, but that was a decision made, as I understand it, under duress by people who were associated with the time, at the time, with the GMO industry. And I'm there has not been a whole lot of further investigation, scientific investigation. Plus, I would like to say that organic crops are millennia old. Traditional crops are centuries old, at least in the United States, a couple of centuries old. But GMO crops are only 20 years in existence, and we don't know. We just don't know what problems might arise from that. If, you know, it's nice to have neighbors work with neighbors, and in Oregon they mostly do, but you don't always have a good neighbor. So there needs to be some, once again, some sort of legitimate way that a farmer can keep damages from happening to his crop, or take or receive costs for that. Many people have tried to fight the farmer next door, and the farmer will say, it's not my fault, it's the company that had the seed, they have to pay. And the GMO manufacturer like Monsanto and another couple of big companies will come in, and they basically are gorillas in the litigation. So the farmer who grows his traditional crop and is harmed, or his organic crop and is harmed, has very little recourse. The royalty agreement signed by purchasers of propagants, the, in other words, I'd like to specifically talk about Bill HB 2675 that requires certain merchants to provide the State Department of Agriculture with copies of royalty agreements. I think that you could tell by the close vote in the GMO labeling law that a good many, half, but probably more than half, of the citizens of this of Oregon are interested in having GMO labeling for GMO and non-GMO crops. And if you have GMO crops labeled for, to begin with, it's easier and much less costly to say this contains GMO products and this does not contain GMO products. So it'd be a real boon for the labeling process, which I hope does become a reality. Somebody asked a question, I'm not sure who did, about the fund and the funding. If there are no funds, I think that if there is no fund pool for damages, I think that GMO crop growers should establish some sort of insurance so that they can pay damages to whatever farmer has possibly been damaged by their crop. I'd like to talk about that. If you don't fix something that's not broken, if it's not broke, don't fix it. As soon as I thought I came to that, I thought, well, if we wait in this instance for something to break, then the horses are already out of the barn. So it's another little saying. We don't want to wait for that. I have a lot of other philosophical notes, but I think that's probably it for right now.
Okay. Any questions for Pat? Okay, thank you.
Okay.
So, Greg, Barry, Scott, I got three seats. Blake, you're on the outs unless somebody wants to swap out. I don't know if anybody wants to coordinate there, but I've got Greg Berry and Scott first. Scott defers to Blake. That's fine. Come on up. Greg.
Okay, good afternoon. Chair Witt, committee members, appreciate being here. Greg Loberg, I'm the manager of West Coast Beet Seed Company. I'm on the boards of several seed associations and also served on the governor's task force on GE last year. West Coast Beet Seed Company, and I'm going to give you the probably the three-minute version of a five-minute presentation, but the entire presentation is available to put on the record. The company that I work for has been in existence since 1940, growing seed since that time. At one point in the 1980s, all of the sugar beet seed used to produce sugar in the U.S. was grown in the Willamette Valley. Today, most of it still is. As in all seed crops, and there are a lot of them in Oregon, genetic purity is an essential quality attribute. It has been since 1940 in our case, long before the advent of biotechnology. Seed production of the cousins of sugar beet, I'll call them, red beet, Swiss chard, also began in the Willamette Valley, near as we can tell, in the 1940s. Up until 1980, there was an informal system put in place for farmers and the people they did business with, seedsmen, to keep distances between competing crops at a standard that would allow for good genetic purity. In 1980, the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association formed. And at that time, a formal system of mapping and pinning, and those terms have been used interchangeably today, was put in place. And that was the primary function of the group, although there are other reasons for the group to exist. This model has been highly successful and has drawn worldwide attention, as evidenced by the accelerating expansion of the industry. Disputes are uncommon. In 35 years of existence of this association, arbitration has averaged, and there are rules of arbitration written into our guidelines, arbitration has averaged less than one incident per year and has been 100% successful at resolving conflict. Two parties are in play, two growers, two seedsmen. They agree to abide by the resolution, and no one has ever disagreed with the arbitration decision. At this point in time, this involves 1,200 crops, 1,200 fields, lots of competing crops. Our company alone has approximately 75 growers that we keep track of. So when our company began production of the first deregulated, genetically engineered sugar beet seed with small plantings in 2005, our production area, the Willamette Valley, was already utilizing a world-class set of guidelines that allowed a very seamless transition to maintaining genetic purity for yet one more trait. So I think the question that this committee is facing in looking at House Bills 2674 and 75 comes down to whether or not existing volunteer systems are sufficient to preserve a mix of food, feed, and seed production that includes crops with GE traits. From the viewpoint of seed, the answer is yes, the voluntary system has worked quite well. In fact, in the Seed Association, we have one member who produces exclusively organic seed. We have another member who produces some organic seed, but also produces conventional seed. Our company has at least two growers that I know of who produce GE sugar beets in the same farm operation that produces non-GE conventional crops and organic crops. So my view of these two House bills is that conflict resolution is moved from neighbors and the people they do business with to a state agency. With so few actual conflicts, what advantages does either of these bills create for Oregon? If a new method of conflict resolution is to come into play, into being, and to create control areas, which actually are zones of exclusion, I think that that will establish several new borders along the edges of these control areas. I would suggest that the number of conflicts will grow significantly, not become less. We will have farmers outside of the control areas that are privileged to work with their neighbors to coexist. Conversely, we will have farmers inside control areas who do not share those privileges of freedom to coexist with neighbors as they have for generations. There have been a lot of questions. I expect there will be some more. I think I'll end my testimony there by concluding that I do oppose both bills.
Okay, let's get through all three and then do questions if you don't mind. So, Barry?
Representative Klim, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you today and to represent the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. My wife and I farm about 20 miles due east of Portland. We raise a little over 100 varieties of different kinds of flowers, vegetables, fruits, berries, pumpkins, and a number of other things, most of which are patented or have a royalty in one way or other. None of them are GE. I served as a member of the Governor's GE Task Force. I was appointed and recently reappointed by the Secretary of Agriculture to the United States Department of Agriculture's Committee on Biotechnology and 21st Century Agriculture with a specific intent of looking at potentials for compensation and coexistence. The committee's 22 members from all aspects of agriculture made recommendations to the Secretary to develop educational materials and strategies to assist and enhance farmer-to-farmer collaboration. They dismissed the need for compensation mechanism, indemnity funds, and suggested that should any need arise in the future, that it should be dealt with in a crop insurance format as opposed to an indemnity fund placed on only GE side of the agricultural sector. I serve as a farmer representative of the GEMA Accord to establish the parameters to deal with patented traits as they come off of patents. And additionally, I serve on the executive committee of the United States Biotech Crops Alliance. Interesting, since I don't raise biotech for our customers. However, coexistence. Oregon Farm Bureau represents the diversity of agriculture. Our members, and I just lost it, our members include organic growers, conventional growers, those who utilize biotechnology, and some who do all three on their farms. Conversations around coexistence aren't just about biotechnology, but are important for all of us that are involved in agriculture. Oregon is not unique in the discussion around coexistence. The AC21 published a 2012 report on enhancing coexistence to the Secretary of Agriculture. There was a federal rulemaking on enhancing agricultural coexistence. Next week, I will be serving as an invitee to an APHIS meeting on coexistence in North Carolina, to which I understand approximately 100 folks from all aspects of agriculture have been invited. In 2006, a report by the Pew and National Association of Departments of Agriculture talked about coexistence as part of a multi-stakeholder workshop. Another 2006 peer-reviewed report from the University of California on the coexistence of diverse corn production. Lost it again. Damn technology, I should have you down here fixing this. 2014, the Governor's GE Task Force. All of these discussed at length and with quite disparate differences of opinion the importance of coexistence from farmer to farmer. The Oregon Farm Bureau sat on along with that task force along with groups on both sides of the issue. Coexistence works. It takes good communication and farmers working together using the best information to control pollen flow so that all farmers can achieve their production goals. Agriculture has a history, a proud history of innovation of change, and no segment of agriculture, no state, has a more diverse agriculture than does Oregon, and we're very proud of that. And growers have always adapted to new approaches or challenges by utilizing appropriate strategies, management practices, and new technologies. Oregon should not be mandating coexistence by prohibiting or regulating one agricultural crop over another. Coexistence is more than genetic engineering. I have a neighbor, and we had some real challenges. He did not believe in the use of herbicides. As a result of that, about a 50-foot buffer strip along 200 and some feet of that border on my side of the property is full of 5 different noxious weeds that I have a real challenge in dealing with. After years of discussion, we probably still really don't like each other, but we've come to the conclusion that both of us have an obligation across that side of the fence. We've worked it out. The challenges have been met. I still have the noxious weeds, but I now have an opportunity to deal with them without them continually coming on board. We worked it out. It's not rocket science. To mandate a system that pinpoints one form of agriculture at the expense of others is particularly sad public policy. The effect will be a map for the type of destruction we saw to farmers' crops in Jackson County and in Hawaii. I have to disagree with Representative Buckley regarding prohibiting farmers from growing GE crops. The bill would give ODA the ability to establish reserve areas and restrict what farmers can and can't grow on their property in those areas. As to inadvertent presence, the USDA has clearly stated that certification on the National Organic Program is not threatened by the inadvertent presence of genetically engineered products. The fee structure that would fund this proposal would place all of the burden on one group of farmers for a system that, according to previous testimony, would benefit all growers. It does not appear to be a very, very equitable mechanism if the real goal is to enhance coexistence. With regard to patented crops, USDA's Agriculture Marketing Service includes a list of patent-protected varieties of crops in the United States. 417 pages of an Excel spreadsheet type of format, the majority of which are not GE. And I take exception to the comment earlier that they are only utility patents. These are patents about color. They're patents about size. Most of the flowers that my wife raises and does an excellent job if you're looking for flowering baskets this spring, most of them are in some way or another protected by a patent. It's not a utility patent. These are beautiful patents, beautiful things that are protected by patents so that the companies that invested in that are able to reap the benefits of it. This bill would single out only those few patents off that list that are GE patents at the exclusion of all the rest. And I'm certainly not suggesting that we support the bill and include all 417 pages of patents in the state's laws. Patents exist on GE and non-GE crops. Oregon is known for growing seed varieties that supply farmers in all states and even other parts of the world. There are many patents that are both organic, and there are many patents that are GE, and there are many patents that are neither. As an example, one of Oregon Farm Bureau's state board members is an organic farmer, and he holds a few patents on seeds that he has developed. This legislation sets a precedent of regulatory infringement against patented crops. Farmers and companies invest significant resources to develop crop varieties, and their proprietary work should be protected and not regulated against. Patent and technical use information is already publicly available. Google it anywhere you like, and to add further costly requirements to an already overburdened Department of Agriculture seems short-sighted to me. In the end, I am as concerned about agriculture and its diversity in Oregon as anyone in the room. I too want a good crop of high quality and marketability. I am aware of what my neighbors are, who they are, and what they are raising. There are always challenges in agriculture. There will always be challenges of agriculture. Farmers have always risen to the challenges since before statehood, and frankly, without the state's intervention. Thank you.
Chair Clem and members of the committee, my name is Blake Rowe, and I am the CEO for the Oregon Wheat Growers League. We represent Oregon's wheat growers, some nearly 2,000 farms across the state. We're one of the larger commodities, account for some 31% of Oregon's harvested acres. I'm not sure people realize how extensive wheat is in terms of its extent across the state. We account for some 13% of Oregon's agricultural exports. Directly contribute around $400 million a year to the economy, and according to a recent study we had done at OSU, over $800 million in overall value added. Our crop is largely an exported crop. In 2013, we were the number two ag export by value. In many years, we are number one. It just depends on the particulars of a year's crop and the wheat price. Roughly 90% of our crop goes offshore, primarily into the Pacific Rim. We certainly value some of our local niche markets, whether they're organic or specialties, folks that contribute to artisan bakeries that sort of thing. We like them, we support them, but first and foremost, wheat is a globally competitive commodity market, and we are very focused on participating in that global market. Unlike some other crops, GE is still part of our future. GE wheat is not yet in commercial production anywhere in the world, although it is actively being developed by any number of companies and universities, and we are confident that it will be part of our future. We are very conscious of both sides of the discussion, both the incredible potential that GE wheat represents to us in terms of being able to better serve the needs of the world's population, being able to produce with less water, less fertilizer, fewer pesticides on less land with a reduced carbon footprint. Those are all things that could be part of the future with GE technology, with biotechnology. That said, we're also very cognizant that many of our customers do not at this point want a genetically engineered wheat product. That's the balance. And I think we feel, our growers feel, that is our responsibility to figure it out. We'll figure it out. As it comes forward, as GE wheat becomes a reality, that's our responsibility. We have many growers who have successfully dealt with other crops. They don't just grow wheat. They've dealt with GE and non-GE interface. They've dealt with organic versus conventional. They've dealt with hybridization, pollen buffers, timing of crops. It's not like we aren't aware of the kinds of techniques that can be brought to bear. So we get it, and we feel like this is part of our responsibility as we look out into the future. We are not supporters of either of these bills. Seed purchase and royalty agreements, we consider those to be proprietary business documents. Once a crop is deregulated by USDA, we should not have to get ODA's permission or a control area in order to grow a legal wheat crop. We get the risks and the issues that GE wheat will present. Market acceptance, segregation in the supply chain, we get it. We know we have to manage those. That's our job, and we think growers should take the lead on dealing with that when the time comes. Is it possible, you know, some of the other folks here might have me out in the hall, is it possible that there's a role for ODA? It's possible, but it's at the end of the process. ODA shouldn't be leading the growers in these questions. They should be helping what growers can already do, that coexistence. Could there be a role? Yeah, I will say it's possible. But it's not at the front end. It's not ODA taking the lead. It's growers taking the lead. That's how it's always worked. That's how our growers have made it work. And that's how I think we will make it work when GE becomes part of our future. This is a big issue because biotech, we think, will be a big part of the future. So I know the mantra about being careful what you volunteer for, but the wheat growers are willing to be part of the discussion. Because what happens with these two bills and what happens with these issues will have a big effect on whether biotechnology will be available to us so that we can be competitive in the world market. Thank you.
Okay, so question for these gentlemen. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's suppose these two bills were to pass. Would there be anything to prevent in the next legislative session a bill coming forward that would address the problem that the chairman described earlier, where we had an organic farmer move in amongst a number of more traditional farmers. We had a lot of concern that the traditional farmers might be sued because their practices varied from the organic farmer. What would prevent us from having a bill that excluded organic crops next session?
I'll be happy to address that. First of all, I want to once again make it clear that Oregon Farm Bureau respects all types of agriculture. We have members from all. We don't want anyone pitted against the other.
But I think the chairman made it very clear that, in fact, someone earlier mentioned canola. I mean, the mere fact that this legislature opened up an opportunity to determine one type of agriculture and one type of a crop having precedence and priority over another, that standard has been set. This bill would reaffirm that standard, that it is the legislature that is setting the determinations of what is and what isn't grown on farms, and not farmers. So the answer, simple answer to your question is absolutely nothing.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
Can you tell us what this tit-for-tat would do for the family, the agricultural family? Would that be promoting Oregon's agricultural crops here in the state, nationally, globally? Is this something that we want to start?
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, I guess I speak more from the heart on this one than I do anywhere else. I've always been particularly proud of Oregon's agriculture and its diversity. We've set national standards for what we do, what we export, who we are, and I'm proud of that. And the only way you have that diversity is you have an acceptance that all of them are important. And what I see is this piece by piece dismantling of that pride at the expense of a few people that have a particular market that they want to protect. Now, God only knows I'm going to protect my market. I just tried to sell you flowers. But I don't think it's appropriate, nor is it necessary, for the legislature to get involved in those marketing discussions. I'm a businessman above all else. I love farming. I left a long career in high school teaching after 15 years to come back to the family farm. I did that because that's what I wanted to do. And it's important that we protect those markets, but it's my responsibility to protect my market. When I sign contracts, earlier it was alluded to about the various contracts and the requirements for specificity and quality. When I sign a contract, I'm the one that determines what that contract entails. I do it primarily because I want an enhanced profitability, I want an enhanced market, I want to make as much money as I can on my farm for the work that I do, not unlike any other American for whatever job or whatever things they're trying to do. So when I do that, I also accept a business risk. And in inherently signing a contract that has, in some cases I hear of zero tolerance, the responsibility for that zero tolerance is not my neighbor's, it's mine. In fact, if you look at the, and I don't want to be misconstrued here, but when you look at the National Organic Program, the responsibility for seed quality under that certification is on you. That's patently clear under USDA's National Organic Program. It's not on your neighbor. Now, the neighbor should work with you very carefully and say, okay, look, I'm going to plant my corn on this date. How about you planting yours on the next date? I've told this story too many times and people get upset with me, but there's a large grower in California that does organic, GE, and conventional seed all on his farm, and a lot of it's corn. I ask him, how big a buffer strip do you have between those three types of corn? His answer was 30 inches. He puts different day lake seed in each one of the separate planters that's separated by 30 inches, and he goes to beat heck and plants it. They don't cross-pollinate. Biologically, it's impossible for them to do so because they create pollen at different times because they have different seed day lengths. You can work with your neighbors. You can work with the industry. And I think what Greg talked about earlier is a success story that we ought to be adopting, not challenging and not throwing out the window with these types of bills.
Sorry. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Did you want to add something to that, Craig?
Chair Witt and the representative, Chair Clem, Representative Witt. I just wanted to point out that I think in the context of your question, we could and should add that creating control areas potentially creates an endless cycle of new boundaries, new control areas, more boundaries, because you're going to have farmers that are either privileged or not privileged, either inside because they want to be or outside where they don't want to be or do want to be. And I don't see an end to that cycle of control areas. There's nothing in this legislation that would indicate that from a state level there could not be many rounds of regulation. And I think that this is why I say these border wars, that's not the term I used the first time around, but there is potentially a lot of border conflict in the creation of control areas that are built around market reasons. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Just a lot of stuff going through my head. Unfortunately, so much of it is going back to last year and all that we went through with the ballot measure and how that ties in and all that's going on, so I can't help but a lot of thoughts going through my mind. So I want to just bounce it. First of all, one of the reasons I was thrilled to get on this committee is because I'm a wannabe farmer. All my life I've wanted to farm. I can only grow one thing, it's tomatoes, and they grow okay in my backyard. My next door neighbor has these berry bushes that come through every summer into tangles into my tomatoes. I know you're going, where am I going with this? I'm getting there.
We're waiting for you to get to the pot. It's about to be legal.
I was not going there.
All right.
The berry vine, I know you guys, and you're killing me. Anyway, the vine comes through, it tangles with my tomatoes. My point is back to the coexistence and all what we have heard and good neighbors. And of course, there's a neighbor that's a jerk sometimes, and you know that's life. But according to what you said a little while ago, and I wrote it down, 0 out of 1,200 approximately conflicts, I think you said, or was that what you said?
Could I clarify?
Yeah, please do.
The Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association maps approximately 1,000 to 1,200 field locations per year. In the last few years, that has been 1,200. These are many different crops, many of which have no competitive pollination, cross-pollination effect on one another. Many of them do. The point is that the association has devised guidelines that all members adhere to for mutual benefit. It's a win-win. This is not done because one member is trying to exclude another member. There are rules put in place to try to protect those productions. I want to be clear that the 1,200 sites that may have existed in a particular year represent many different crops, some of which do not cross-pollinate with one another, some of which do. And so we, with a history of 35 years, I don't know in past years how many fields were pinned. It was done on a paper map at the county extension offices. It's another thing to count those versus what we do electronically now. But if you look at a 35-year history, clearly thousands upon thousands of fields have been established, many of them subject to cross-pollinating with one another. We have fewer than one per year, so I didn't go back in the archives. I don't think there's a record. But some years we do not have an arbitration at all, rarely more than one. So the conflicts have been resolved successfully, grower to grower, seedsman to seedsman, 100% of the time.
Okay.
Yeah, follows.
Again, my bad illustration, the tomato and the vine. So it sounds like you've answered that question for me to a certain degree. I'm kind of going with what Representative Witt has said already. I wrote notes to myself. I fear regulation of any crops. That bothers me. This whole, even the words control areas, I was not there, but I'm there was a time when the horse transitioned to the horseless carriage, and there were probably horror stories of we need to control these crazy new things. That's what I sense from control areas. We need to control this crazy new thing because I don't quite understand it. That's what I keep hearing when I hear control areas and got to put it over here and we got to make sure it's not over there and it's going to affect my life and maybe not your life. Do you see where I'm going? I'm throwing this to all three of you. Sorry.
Your turn.
I'm not sure I know what to do with that.
What? You know, if I let Scott answer it, he's back there and he still has to talk.
Scott?
I'll take a stab at it if the other two don't.
I don't even make sense to myself sometimes, so pardon me, but I have a lot of thoughts here.
Chair Clemen.
Yeah, cool with that one.
I just let you out, basically.
Representative Post. This is a philosophical divide. In the GE task force, we had irreconcilable differences. We spent most of a year, many meetings, lots of hours, lots of reading. We could not resolve irreconcilable differences. The testimony you're hearing today is going to be on two sides of a GE argument. And we're not going to reconcile our differences today either. really it goes back to what I said earlier in my testimony. This is about, does our current system function well? I think it does. Would a state-run system improve that function or make it worse? Would it set up future conflicts that we haven't foreseen? I think so. If I haven't addressed your question well enough on tomatoes and what grows through the fence, let me know.
Thank you. Okay. That's fine.
So, Scott, would you like to testify? Okay, let me get Scott up here.
One,
why don't we have one person at least swap out to get Scott at least moving up here, and Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is quick and easy, and Mr. Loberg, you're the last one standing up there, and you're the one I wanted to ask this to.
Stay up here with Scott.
Yeah, you can stay, Barry.
Do you want us to stay here?
Yeah, please.
I'm listening.
Sorry.
For a project that I have to admit is very much different than the one we're talking about today, on a different committee I sit on, this pinning system has been identified as a potential problem solver for us when we're talking about how to make hemp and adult recreational marijuana cohabitate out on the landscape. I would be very appreciative if you could provide me those guidelines that your association has set up to my office so that I can look at them and learn and start thinking about how they might fit that problem.
Chair Clam, Representative, Vice Chair Helm. I have been located already by people that are working on behalf of coexistence of hemp, cannabis for industrial purposes versus their words, not mine, psychoactive cannabis. And so we do have a website, Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association. Okay. That would be an easy start for you. WVSSA has a website. The production guidelines and other forms are at that website. I will also be providing, because someone at the Oregon Department of Ag and someone at Oregon State recommended me to talk to people who are working on this issue of coexistence, I will be talking tomorrow morning with a couple of folks.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Scott, you're up.
Sorry. Thank you. That. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Dahlman. I'm the Policy Director for Oregonians for Food and Shelter. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I will try to keep my comments brief. I've submitted some written comments as well, but I think there's some things in here that can offer some clarity to some of the questions that were asked earlier as well that might help bring some things to light. So for those of you unfamiliar with our organization, Oregonians for Food and Shelter, it's a grassroots coalition. We represent farmers, foresters, and other technology users. We focus on issues involving pesticides, fertilizer, and biotechnology. So genetically engineered crops are a priority for us and a priority for our members. We are here today in opposition to both bills. I'll kind of speak to both bills at the same time because although they differ in the details, fundamentally and philosophically, they're very similar in what they're doing and how overall they're trying to do that. So while they're slightly different in tact, they both divide Oregon agriculture instead of promoting coexistence. At OFS, we have members that are involved in organic agriculture, conventional agriculture, GE agriculture. We support all of it. We believe that Oregon's agriculture diversity is what makes Oregon agriculture special. You know, we have over 200 different commodities in the state and all the different methods you can think of, including conventional, organic, and biotech. Because of this diversity, though, coexistence is key. Farmers work with neighbors to ensure everybody is able to grow the crops that work for their operation. Coexistence is possible. Farmers have had to coexist for neighbors for generations. Organic, GE, those are more recent developments, but farmers have had to coexist since way before that. Before, these are not unique. Before either of these types of crops existed, if a farmer was growing field corn next to a farmer that's growing sweet corn and they weren't careful, you were going to want to eat that sweet corn. They had to work with their neighbors, and they've been able to do that. We continue to support anything that encourages that coexistence. If we can find ways to encourage growers to talk to each other, to work together, to get through any conflicts that may exist. Unfortunately, these bills do not promote neighbors working together, but end up pitting one type of agriculture against the rest.
Both bills have a built-in presupposition that GE crops are somehow more dangerous to neighboring crops than any other non-GE version of the same crop, which simply is not true. As you've heard, ODA already has the authority to create control areas. That authority is limited to control areas for pests and disease concerns. The reason that they do not have control areas on any of the GE crops on the market today is because specifically at the federal level, there is a determination made on GE crops before they are released into the market. Part of that determination is made from APHIS, which is under USDA, and the specific determination is that they do not pose a pest or disease risk. Because of that, by the time it comes down to ODA, they're not going to create a control area for pests and disease on something that's already gone through a review process that says it isn't a pest or disease. So they have that authority and can use it when appropriate. And if there is something that is a plant pest or disease, they should use that authority, and we encourage that. There's also been a lot said today about risk to neighboring crops. And there's a lot of fear of what could happen if GE crops are uncontrolled. You should know a few things. The adventitious presence of GE material does not affect USDA organic status. There has never been a farmer in the United States who has lost their USDA organic status from the inadvertent presence, no matter how much it is, of GE material. That guidance is for the standards, and so it has never happened. So there's perceived risk out there, but when it comes to USDA organic certification, they've made it very clear there isn't a risk there. On the patent issue, they mentioned some court cases that have recently in the last couple of years been decided. The court case that said that there may be a case to go after somebody for adventitious presence also in the same ruling dismissed the case because they could not find a single case where a technology holder had ever gone after somebody for adventitious presence. They had sued Monsanto specifically, and Monsanto came and showed their decades of materials that said they will never go after a farmer for the adventitious presence. And the court looked at that and said, we can't rule on this because these farmers have not been sued for adventitious presence, and you cannot demonstrate any other farmer that ever has. Again, a perceived risk out there, but when it plays out in reality, it's just not happening. Cross-pollination is concerned for growers regardless if rather it's from GE or conventional plants. If they're plants in the same family and they can cross-pollinate, there's risk. But just because it's GE, it makes it nothing specific. And what both of these bills do is call out GE. And let's remember what GE is. It's just a different way of how the plant was bred. We're not talking about something dramatically different here. It was a way, the process in which it was bred. And I'll mention that as this goes forward, you'll want to be very careful in the definitions we use for GE, because the definitions of both of these bills, I had some scientists review them, and they said that in at least one of the bills, it could apply to just about anything that's ever been bred. So we have to be very, very careful in how we do this. These bills would take away a farmer's right to choose the crop that works best for them. You can try to frame it differently, but if I have a family farm, a century farm, and I'm in an area that has just been designated an exclusion zone, I can't move that farmland somewhere. Now I'm stuck where I am, and I've just had a tool taken away from me that other farmers in the state and farmers nationally get to use. And they do use it, and they use it because it works. That's why this is the fastest adopted crop technology we've ever seen, because it works, and farmers need to use them. And we're going to set up a scenario where we tell farmers that on their family farm they're not able to grow that anymore. That doesn't promote coexistence. It's the very antithesis of that. Two last things. I know we're running out of time here. I can see that look.
We have another committee.
Yeah, I know. So 2674 specifically has a compensation fund for non-GE growers. And I just wanted to point out, even if you want to consider something like that, which we are opposed to. The way it's drafted now, it would only apply to people who are outside an area where GE crops are grown anyway. So the way it's written now doesn't even make sense. And then the last thing is both bills require seed dealers to send copies of royalty agreements for GE crops to ODA. There's nothing in here for protecting it from public records at all, which means that planting dates, planting locations, other proprietary business information would be available to anybody that asks. And we are very fearful of what that could lead to. And that's not just fear-mongering. I will call your attention to just two summers ago in 2013, where 6,500 GE sugar beet plants were destroyed over two nights during the summer, ripped up because they were GE crops. The risk is real. So with that, please oppose both bills. We want to continue to work with you on anything that will help promote coexistence. I know we're running out of time. I'm happy to answer questions now or reach out to me later.
Representative McLean.
What I've heard from testimony today about what's broke is four things, and So it would be helpful if the proponents and opponents of these two bills could communicate in these four ways to Chairman Clem and the committee. It just maybe in a memo to help. Number one, GE is bad. Meaning that there's a dispute here that a USDA certified or approved GE crop somehow is different than another crop, and that the risk of cross-pollinization or cross-contamination, all that, is higher. And I've asked for science to prove that. So the second thing is that sales. There's a perception of the customers or consumers or purchasers of Oregon products, and we've got to deal with that whether we like it or not. Third, Senate Bill 863 requires it. And I guess the question is, does it? Does 863 require bills be passed? And then fourth, patent law requires it. So I've heard all four reasons as to why we need this. And it would be helpful, because I've heard you actually talk about all four, but if it's helpful to me, and excuse my presumption, Chair Clem, but I think it would be helpful to the committee if we actually tried to figure out what's really broke here in those four areas, and then at least we could try to cut the noise and just really see, do we need these bills? And if so, what do these bills need to say for what reason? Does that make sense? And I appreciate your indulgence on that.
Yeah. Just for an anecdote here, Clem, the first patent on a biological, on a life form, was done by Louis Pasteur in 1873.
Anything else? What I will say is there is a Senate bill that I asked not to... I knew we'd need a lot of time for these, but not to have discussed today, that what I would like to do is, if folks are interested in understanding that Senate bill and how it interplays with these, it's got a different approach. It was brought by the former governor, and now the natural resource advisor offered to come today, and I said, let's just talk about these. But it has a little bit different approach, where instead of like a control district, it's more like a market district. It's the concept that's already privately happening in some areas, but it could be triggered by people from both sides coming forward and saying, we're having some conflicts here. We're interested in trying to figure out, you know, buffers and pinning systems and something like that. So at some point, I think they probably want to make their pitch on their bill. I'm not sure if the committee is going to have time for that bill, given it's a Senate bill, to be heard here, or if it's ever going to make it here. But I think what I want to do is appoint a work group to take that bill plus these bills, get the answers to Representative McLean's questions in that context for people who might want to continue to work on this coexistence issue. So with that, we really stole 15 minutes from the next committee. Thank you all for your patience. Oh, and sorry for the annexation folks who came today. I should have told you it was unlikely that we were going to get through this, but I really didn't know. So I'm going to carry over
my two bills, while I lobby them harder before Aaron convinces you not to vote for them, House Bills 2720 and House Bill 2938. Sorry, Jerry. Sorry, Jerry.